From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, faces, close up and larger than life, with every wrinkle and every pore detailed. We talk with artist Chuck Close. He's made paintings of faces since the 60s. Now his paintings are collected in a major retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, an exhibition described in The New Yorker as exhilarating and dazzling. It's not just his paintings that are remarkable. The fact that he can still paint is remarkable. Nearly 10 years ago, a stroke left him largely paralyzed from the neck down. Chuck Close, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. White House Budget Director Franklin Raines is leaving. President Clinton, who accepted the resignation with regret, showered Raines with praise.
Frank Raines has been, in short, a brilliant OMB director, a leader of this administration, a trusted advisor, an able spokesperson, and a real friend.
Raines was the first director to assemble a balanced budget in nearly 30 years. Deputy OMB Director Jack Lew has been nominated to succeed Raines. A leading communist says Russian lawmakers should reluctantly approve President Boris Yeltsin's candidate for prime minister rather than lose their jobs. Alistair Wanklin reports from Moscow.
The communist speaker of Russia's State Duma, Gennady Selezhnev, said continuity in parliament is more important than whether deputies accept or reject Sergei Kiryenko as prime minister. Selezhnev said the Duma should avoid early elections, which Yeltsin has threatened to call if deputies reject Kiryenko. Selezhnev was speaking after a meeting with the Russian president. He quoted Yeltsin as saying it's time for the older generation to step aside in Russian politics. Many deputies have criticized the 35-year-old Kiryenko as too inexperienced. They rejected him in a first vote last week. Another is planned this Friday. Observers say if the Duma doesn't approve him then, there could be one further vote, by which time deputies would have to assess whether it's worth risking having to stand again in nationwide elections. For NPR News, I'm Alastair Wanklin in Moscow.
Two suspected Bosnian Serb war criminals have pleaded not guilty to crimes against humanity. The men were arrested last week by NATO troops. They're charged with atrocities at the Serbian-run Omarska prison camp. They'll be tried by the War Crimes Tribunal. Gillian Sharp reports from The Hague.
Pleading the charges against Miroslav Kvatka and Mladen Radic took well over an hour. Kvatka was second in command at Omarska and Radic was a shift commander. Prosecutors say conditions there were brutal and the Muslim and Croat prisoners were routinely and openly murdered, raped, tortured and constantly humiliated. Their positions of authority mean both men are held accountable for their own actions and those of their subordinates. Neither man made any comment at Tuesday's court appearance, standing only to answer not guilty to all the charges. Radic also entered a not guilty plea to a charge that he repeatedly raped a woman prisoner. The tribunal now has 25 people in custody, but its most wanted suspect, former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, is still free. For NPR News, I'm Gillian Sharp in The Hague.
The president of the Czech Republic, Václav Havel, has been hospitalized in Austria with a suspected perforated colon. Havel had been vacationing at the time. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 74 points at 9,086. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is on the march to its next big barrier, 9,100. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
After starting the week with a close back up above 9,000, Wall Street is again heading higher. Better than expected earnings reports and new government economic numbers that show inflation in check are driving the market. Johnson & Johnson says its first quarter earnings rose 11%. Earnings at film and photography company Kodak fell for the first 3 months of the year, but investors apparently decided it could have been worse. Looking at the economic numbers, the Labor Department says inflation at the consumer level was pretty much non-existent last month. Consumer price index was unchanged. Retail sales fell 0.1%. Meanwhile, the biggest earnings report of the day from chipmaker Intel won't be released until after the market closes. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Computer software maker Microsoft has set a date for the release of its new operating system, Windows 98. It will be June 25th. A spokesman says an upgrade for the operating system will cost about $109, but new buyers will have to pay more than $200 for the material. Microsoft says the program's main improvement permits the company to weave its internet browser more closely into the computer system. A group of teenaged workers is striking McDonald's in Macedonia, Ohio. One striker says the group is upset with inequities in pay, bad relations with management, understaffing, and too much teasing. A McDonald's spokeswoman says the owner-operator of the restaurant will meet with the angry workers tomorrow. The National Council of Chain Restaurants says this is the first time it's heard of a strike against McDonald's. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, a place to satisfy existing curiosities and discover new ones. Location information at 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our faces reveal so much about who we are. That's part of what makes Chuck Close's paintings so fascinating. They offer you the chance to stare at larger-than-life, hyper-realist renderings of faces. Faces that become transformed into what Time magazine art critic Robert Hughes describes as moonscapes of pores, wrinkles, blackheads, and stubble. Close has been painting faces since the 60s. It's amazing that he can paint at all now. Nearly 10 years ago, a stroke left him paralyzed from the neck down. After a partial recovery, he's been able to paint from his wheelchair. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is showing a retrospective of Close's work. I asked Chuck Close why the face has been his subject for so long.
Well, initially I started making portraits, or at that time I didn't even call them portraits, I called them heads, because it was as different as possible from what I had been doing before. My work had been abstract, and I was looking for something that was diametrically opposed to what I had done as a student. And so the first heads were just my friends, and I had no idea then 30 years ago that I would still be painting heads today. And in fact, I'm sure I wouldn't have believed it if somebody had predicted it. But over the years, I found that of all the kinds of subject matter that I could use, nothing interests me as much as people, and it offers the viewer an entrance into the work through a life experience, because we all look in mirrors and look at each other and look at images in magazines and film. And it's a great leveler, whether a person is the most sophisticated person in the art world or a lay person. We all share that knowledge of an interest in the way people look. And then hopefully once somebody gets into the painting, maybe through that the entrance of the life experience, they'll notice some other things that are going on in the paintings and become involved in that as well.
The technical aspect and the aesthetic aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I think the work is, although they're considered realistic, I think I'm as interested in artificiality as I am in reality. And I'm very interested in making paintings, and I want them to hang on the wall with what I think are the better paintings being made today, and not just other portrait paintings. And that I'm interested in people looking at the distribution of marks and colors on a flat surface. That is the painting aspect of the work as well as the image. And in fact, I think today they're really almost split down the middle. Half of the time you see the marks, the strokes, the distribution of paint, and these funny little shapes that occur, and lozenge shapes and donut shapes. And then it warps into the image, and then after you looked at the image for a minute, they seem to rip back to the flat reading of the surface of the painting again.
Let's try to describe what's happening formally in your paintings. Your paintings are built not of like big elaborate brushstrokes, but of little dots or little circles. And it's the accumulation of all these dots or circles or squiggles, depending on the period that we're looking at, that kind of together add up to the larger structure of a face. But all the components are just really small dots or squiggles or bits
yeah, there's
of color.
There's no direct relationship between the photograph that I work from and the imagery that's embedded in that photograph and the marks that occur on the canvas. It's a little bit like translating from one language to the next. If you were to translate it directly, it might not make any sense. You sort of have to understand it in one language and then deconstruct it and reconstruct it in the new format. And, of course, paintings don't happen the same way a photograph happens. My paintings are built incrementally, one unit at a time, in a way that's not all that different from, say, the way a writer would work. There's never any time that a writer is doing anything more than slamming one word up against the next and rejecting one word and slipping another one in and seeing how that works. And because I work incrementally, I do the same thing. I push little pieces of paint up against each other, and I work essentially from the top down, from left to right, and I slowly build these paintings, construct them the way somebody might make a quilt or crochet or knit.
I want to talk a little bit more about the faces themselves, the way you paint the faces themselves. You've said that you tried to see the faces neutrally, without opinion or subjectivity, without editorializing in any way about the face. And yet, the face always reads in some way to me. I see the faces very subjectively, even though you as the painter didn't see them subjectively. Talk with me about the approach that you're taking toward the subject matter, of not kind of imposing any kind of feeling or point of view.
Well, it's not that I'm uninterested in the psychological reading of the paintings. I just don't want to lobby for one reading over all others. And to present them straightforwardly and flat-footedly without editorial comment, without cranking it up for extra psychological readings, or without drawing big circles around things saying, make sure you see it this way, I sort of leave it to the viewer to read the image. And I believe that a person's face is a kind of roadmap to their life. And embedded in the imagery is a great deal of evidence if you want to decode it. If a person has laughed his or her whole life, they'll have laugh lines. If they frown their whole lives, they have furrows in their brow. And it's not necessary for me to have them laughing or crying or anything in order to have people be able to read them.
Your canvases are very large, and because you include every detail of a person's face, every line and wrinkle and pucker and pore, every flaw is included, or what we would consider a flaw is not only included, but it's kind of enlarged because the painting is so large. And that's part of what I find so fascinating. The faces are so real and recognizable. Looking at one of your faces in a painting, it's a lot like looking at yourself in the bathroom mirror with the kind of harsh lighting that you have there, and you see everything. So there's something so recognizable about the landscape of the faces, the way you paint them.
Yeah, I we don't stand close enough to each other. We don't invade each other's space enough to really be able to see the intimate level of detail that I typically put in one of these paintings, because they're, in fact, usually 9 feet high. So if there's more information than you ever really wanted to know about someone, and it makes it perhaps a more intimate experience, I make try to make these big, aggressive, confrontational images that you can see from clear across the room, and you have one kind of relationship with it there, and then another relationship at a middle viewing distance where you scan it and you can't readily see the thing as a whole. And then hopefully I've sucked the viewer right up to the canvas where you can see the individual marks and the methodology, how it got there. But in a way, what I've tried to do is make something, rip it loose from the context in which we normally see it, and make a kind of Brobdignagian world, whereas the viewer behaves almost like one of Gulliver's Lilliputians crawling across the landscape of the face, not even necessarily always being aware of what it is that they're crawling across, stumbling on a beard hair and falling into a nostril. That makes it for a very active and very personal physical experience for the viewer, I think.
What kind of reactions do you get from people whose portraits you've done when they see their own faces blown up like that?
Well, everyone I've painted has had some kind of trouble dealing with it, and I would like to thank my sitters for their act of generosity, their extreme generosity, in lending me their image without knowing what I'm going to do with it and without any control over how I will use it. They have to put vanity aside, and these are not commissioned portraits, so I give them no right to really lobby for me improving the way they look, although I don't try to be particularly, I don't try to be any more ruthless with them than I am with myself. But it is difficult to deal with, and some people have changed the way they look immediately after I painted them. They'll shave their mustache off, or they'll get a haircut, or they'll grow a beard or something. Only one person really anticipated this, and that was my friend, the painter Joe Zucker, who came essentially in disguise. I mean, he realized that all he had to do was present me with evidence that someone like that existed, wasn't necessarily him. And he ended up looking like a sort of Midwest used car salesman for a hundredth of a second. And he never had any trouble. He went home and he washed the Brill cream out of his hair, and it wasn't him. But most people have had to deal with it after I've painted them. But everyone has had, I think, some kind of trouble. If your nose is bent a quarter of an inch in real life, you can ignore it. But when a painting is 9 feet high, it'll be bent 6 inches, and it's very hard to convince yourself that it's not happening.
My guest is painter Chuck Close. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is showing a retrospective of his work. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Chuck Close, and there's a retrospective of his paintings at the Museum of Modern Art. You know, we think of classical painters as having wanted to paint models who were beautiful, but it's not, you know, classic beauty that interests you in faces.
I'm not looking for the grotesque or the ugly. I think
you're looking for the fact of the face.
Well, I'm looking for every man, every woman. I first painted my friends, usually other artists, because they were anonymous, and I didn't want. Warhol was painting superstars and movie stars, and the history and traditions of portraiture have often been. The wealthy, the famous popes, presidents, and I wanted regular people that we didn't know. Unfortunately, or fortunately for them, many of them managed to get famous on me, and they became much more recognizable, at least within the art community. And now I don't worry that much about trying to find anonymous people. And so many of my friends have become well known. I just paint them as they come.
I've read that you've had a learning disability that's affected your ability to actually recognize faces in real life.
Yeah, I think I was probably driven to do what I do because I do have a great deal of difficulty recognizing faces. I have almost photographic vision for things that are two-dimensional, which is probably why I work from photographs instead of working from life. But I believe I was driven to painting the portrait, at least partially, by a desire to commit to memory and to really understand and scan the images of people that I care about because I do have this trouble recognizing faces. And, of course, I don't remember the names either, so I'm in big trouble.
So one of the reasons why you paint from photographs is because you recognize faces better in two dimensions than in three, so it's easier for you to use a picture than a model. Are there other reasons why you work from photographs for your paintings?
Yeah, when you paint from life for an extended period of time, and my paintings have taken as long as 12 or 14 months and routinely now take 3 or 4 months each, if you work from life, the subject gains weight and lose weight. The hair gets long and they cut it off, and they're happy, they're sad, they're awake, they're asleep. And the painting becomes a kind of mean average of all the changes that the model went through, plus whatever feelings you have for them while they're occupying your space. I would hate to have the subject in my studio for a year. So the photograph gives me an opportunity to have a poem-like frozen moment of time, sort of cuts across time, a hundredth of a second. And there's something of the freshness and the immediacy of that hundredth of a second is still there, hopefully, in the finished painting, which I construct over a more novelistic time frame. And it allows me to just keep working and to always refer back to the original photograph to see whether I actually saw what I thought I saw. And I often then recycle that photograph mm-hmm. and make many more images. And it's really wonderful. Every time I go back to the photograph, because I've changed scale, tools, methodology, working method, and whatever, I find totally new information within the photograph that I didn't notice the first time.
Tell us a little bit about the way you work with grids when you're painting a face from a photograph.
Mm-hmm. Well, grids, you know, besides being one of the great modernist conventions, the grid has been around most recently because it's a flattening device. It's a way to, to restate the flatness of the canvas. But in fact, the use of a grid as a scaling up method goes back to ancient Egypt, and was, of course, used in the Renaissance and used all along as a way to take a small drawing or a preparatory sketch and enlarge it by having smaller squares on the preparatory sketch and bigger ones on the painting. It's just a way to scale up an image. But and all of my work from the 1960s on have been built with the use of a grid. I don't use a projector or anything like that to get an image on. But at a certain point, I decided to let the grid remain a visible part of the image. Initially, I would get rid of the grid so nobody knew that I used it. But at a certain point, I began to leave the incremental unit to show. And I found all kinds of ways, from using my own fingerprints to gluing on little wads of pulp paper to any one of a number of ways of working incrementally and letting the individual unit show. One of the things I like about working that way is that there's nothing about the building block which says anything about what's going to be made from it.
Exactly. Right, exactly.
There's no mark that equals hair. There's no mark that equals skin or anything else. It's a little bit like an architect choosing a brick. The brick doesn't determine anything about what kind of building will be built from it. You stack up the bricks one way and you make a gas station, or you stack up the bricks another way and you can build a cathedral. Both of them will be very different experiences, but it wasn't the brick that determined the nature of that experience.
So what suits your personality about working in these smaller units, one dot at a time or one grid at a time?
Well, you know, actually, I'm a nervous wreck. I'm a slob. I have no patience, and I'm rather lazy. All of those things would seem to guarantee that I would not make work like I make. But I felt I didn't want to just go with my nature and say, well, that's the way I am. I can only make big, sloppy, nervous, quick paintings. I thought to construct a situation in which I couldn't behave that way was also to address my nature. But I found that one of the nice things about working this way, working incrementally, is that I don't have to reinvent the wheel every single day. Today I did what I did yesterday, and tomorrow I'll do what I do today. You can pick it up and put it down. I don't have to wait for inspiration. There are no good days or bad days. And I'm every day essentially builds positively on what I did the day before. In some ways, I think it's rather like what used to be called women's work, that is quilting, crocheting, knitting, or whatever. And the advantage of that way of working was that women could knit for a while, put it down, go feed the baby, come back and pick it up and knit a little more, and then put it down and go out and weed the garden. And it allowed for a way to just keep working. If a belief in a process, for instance, how do you make a sweater? Oh my God, I wouldn't know how to make a sweater. But if you believe in the process and you knit one and you purl two long enough, eventually you get a sweater. And I think, given my nature, it was very good for me to have a way to work in which I was able to add to what I already had and slowly construct the final image out of these little building blocks.
How have you dealt with impatience, though? Don't you ever feel like, okay, it's going to take me another 12 months of these dots to have a painting? I want to see it now.
Well, you know, that's I do finish each area as I go, so I have a chance to see what it's going to look like almost from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, patience is a funny thing. I used to work every day and make a painting every day, and now I work every day and I make a painting every several months. But work is work. And it doesn't seem to take any more patience to keep working on one piece than it did to make a different piece every day. And the big difference is that I used to enjoy painting. I loved the activity, but I didn't care very much about what I made. And now I have a way of working which... like I say, is essentially a positive building on what I already have, and eventually I get to something about which I care a great deal more. So for me, that was a very productive trade-off.
Chuck Close, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, is showing a retrospective of his work. He'll be back in the second half of the show, and we'll talk about the stroke that left him largely paralyzed. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with artist Chuck Close and hear how he's managed to keep painting in spite of a stroke which left him largely paralyzed from the neck down. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with painter Chuck Close. Since the 1960s, his subject has been the human face. His larger-than-life paintings of faces are collected in a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. In the first half of the show, we talked about his paintings. Now we're going to hear about a medical condition that transformed his life and nearly ended his ability to paint. It was, I think, 10 years ago that you had a terrible medical problem. I think it was a blood vessel in your spinal cord that broke.
Well, actually, it's very funny that I don't know that your listening audience knows that you're in Philadelphia and I'm in New York, and I'm staring at a microphone instead of staring at you.
Mm-hmm.
It was 9 years ago that I was in this very studio talking to Susan Stamberg about the National Endowment for the Arts, which was the last thing I did before I went up to Gracie Mansion, where I, in fact, suffered this collapsed spinal artery and became, within a matter of a few minutes, a quadriplegic. So it's a little freaky to be in this studio, and I'm sort of wondering about what's going to happen today when I leave. But at any rate, yes, I did have this event in my life in which I ultimately became what's called an incomplete quadriplegic. I was initially paralyzed from the shoulders down, but I got considerable return, and I don't have the I am confined to a wheelchair, and I don't have the use of my my hands. And I paint now with brushes strapped to a brace, which is strapped to my arm. But essentially, I'm not doing anything that I don't think I would have been doing anyway. I think the work has progressed much the same way that it would have. And luckily, I had something to get back to that really mattered to me. If I hadn't already known how to paint, I don't think I could have learned to do it post-injury. But once you know how to do something, it's not so hard to equip yourself with what's necessary to be able to get back to it.
What's amazing is if you were the kind of painter who did canvases with big virtuoso brushstrokes, you would have never been able to keep up with that once you lost your movement. But because you work in these small kind of dots or circles or squiggles and use those as building blocks, you're still with that paintbrush strapped to your hand able to do more or less the same style of painting
right.
that you did before.
I was lucky that the way I was working was ideally suited for the condition I found myself in. The one thing that I haven't been able to do, and it does bring me considerable upset, and is that because my fingers don't move, I haven't found a way to really draw, because drawing requires much more the wrist and the movement of the fingers for a kind of nuanced kind of control. But painting, you really do with your whole arm anyhow. And you move with your shoulder and your elbow more than you do your wrist and fingers.
How do you think your style or your vision has changed in the 9 years that you've been paralyzed?
Well, I don't think there's been much change at all. The one area in which there might be some change is that I think because I have so many more eggs in this basket, there are so many things that I can't do that I used to enjoy doing. Luckily, painting is, if I had to pick one thing that I could still do, it certainly would be painting, and luckily that I can do. But I guess there is a slightly increased sense of celebration in the work, a more celebratory aspect to it, because I am so pleased to be able to still work, and I enjoy the activity so much. And in fact, the days and hours that I paint fly by, and the times that I'm doing other things move at glacial speed, and those times drag on.
Because you don't have much movement now at all and you have to paint with the brushes strapped onto your wrist, have you given a lot of thought to how much painting is something that happens in your mind and how much is something that happens with your hands?
Well, somebody told me in the hospital, and I don't remember who it is, that, oh, you'll be all right because you paint with your head and not with your hands. And I thought, oh, easy for you to say. You know? I thought, gee, this is like something came out of a fortune cookie or something. I was actually quite quite annoyed that they had this this kind of throwaway answer for my very severe problem. But in fact, you know, they were right. Once you know what art looks like, you can figure out how to make some of it. And it's just a question of adaptation. I would like to say also that that part of my ability to get back to work is largely due to the fact that I am and have been for 30 years a very successful artist and have made a lot of money, and I can afford to equip myself with what's necessary to be able to get back to work. I can have a totally wheelchair-accessible studio. I can hire assistants who can get me where I want to go, and I still make the paintings entirely by myself. My assistants don't help me paint, but they help me with all the other things. So if this were to happen to another artist who was not as recognized and celebrated as I was and not as financially successful as I was, no matter how much they might have wished to get back to work, it may have been an impossibility. So again, I think that I'm very lucky.
If you don't mind my asking, I know, you know, often when people lose the ability to move, it's through a traumatic accident, a car crash, or, you know, some kind of terrible injury, a fall. Mm-hmm. But for you, it was a broken artery.
And I just sort of collapsed.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So when did you realize that you had lost movement? Did you awaken from a coma, or was this something that came on gradually?
Well, I had tremendous pain, and I had the pain over the years. It would come and go, and nobody could ever figure out what it was. And this time, the pain ended up. I had sort of massive seizures all over my body, and then all of a sudden, my whole body just was still. And we couldn't figure out what happened. It actually took them several days to figure out what happened to me. I remember my art dealer came in and he said, come on, get out of bed. He was convinced that I had some sort of hysterical paralysis. And it took a while for everyone to figure out what, in fact, did happen.
How did you come up with a system that worked for getting your brush, your paintbrush, attached to your arm in such a way that you could get the kind of mobility and control that you needed?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was in a rehabilitation hospital after a couple of months of being in intensive care and stuff. I was moved to the rehabilitation hospital that was connected to the hospital I was in, and I began rehab, and I remember rolling down the hall one day and seeing the name on a door. It said occupational therapy. I said, oh, great, they'll help me get back to my occupation. But in fact, it was much more about stacking spools and making things out of pipe cleaners. I must say that the therapists were wonderful people and very helpful, but it took the active intervention of my wife, who really went to bat for me and made sure they understood just how important it was for me and my sanity to be able to get back to work. And she convinced the therapist to stop trying to convince me how to do things that I didn't need to do and to get back to what really mattered. And they found me a space in the basement of the building, and I equipped it as a studio and managed to start painting while I was still in rehabilitation.
Were there times when you found yourself trying to make things out of pipe cleaners? And I mean, because that's what you were supposed to be doing in occupational therapy?
Well, you know, they tried to get me to do my laundry. I said, well, you know, I didn't do my laundry before. Why should I want to do my laundry now? And they tried to show me how to, you know, use a computer. And I said, I have absolutely no interest in using a computer. And I really don't want to do it with a pencil stuck in my teeth. So it was a fight because they're trying to bring everybody along and they have a kind of general attitude towards what's liable to be helpful in a person's life. And I was looking for very specific kinds of help.
My guest is painter Chuck Close. Since the 60s, his subject matter has been the face. Nearly 10 years ago, he had a stroke that left him partially paralyzed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Chuck Close, and there's a retrospective of his work at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. I want to say something else and get you to say something else about the current style that you're painting in. Your current painting style now is this really interesting mix of abstraction and representational painting. Because what you're doing now, as we talked about, you know, your paintings are based on a series of grids. And in each grid is like a little abstract painting. Each grid is, you know, is some circles of color or squares of color or squiggles of color. And this little abstract grid, when taken in the context of all the other little abstract grids, forms a face. Mm-hmm. But the faces have become more abstract than they used to be. They're not so much about finding every follicle, every pore,
well, as they once were. It's probably lucky that as I age and all of my friends age, that I've adopted a kinder, gentler strategy to painting because I was in my 20s when I started and we weren't as wrinkled and there wasn't as much surface incident in people's faces, and so right now it's probably a good thing that a lot of that. Surface information isn't showing up, but it actually, one of the things I get to finish one of those little paintings, one of those little abstract paintings, all the time, several a day or a whole bunch of them in a day. So I get a little piece of pleasure over and over and over, and a little piece of completion over and over. And that's one of the really wonderful things about the way I work. But, you know, I didn't start making representational imagery because I was against abstraction. As a matter of fact, my favorite work was usually abstract, often very minimal, and often sculpture.
Don't you feel like you found a way to combine all of those instincts into one canvas?
That's one of the nice things about it. You know, I was a big, big fan as a student of de Kooning, who I still consider the greatest American artist of the 20th century. And I loved him so much, and I was I painted way more than my share of de Kooning's. In fact, when I met de Kooning late in life, I said it's very nice. Late in his life, I said it's very nice to meet somebody who's painted more de Kooning's than I have. But one of the problems with being a good student, and I was a good student, was that I knew what art looked like, and I could demonstrate that I knew what it looked like. But it must look like someone else's art, or it wouldn't look like art. And I couldn't find a way to work out of de Kooning and out of my heroes without making weak impersonations of their work. And one of the wonderful things about having purged my work of all those influences and driving myself into my own idiosyncratic corner where no one else's answers would fit the question that I was asking myself, was that ultimately, over the years, I found a way to get a lot of that de Kooning color and some of the marks and things that I love so much back into my work. But now I get to use de Kooning color and make a Chuck Close instead of using de Kooning color and making a de Kooning.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, something that's interesting about the current series of paintings, or at least latest series of paintings on exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, it's because it's a kind of figurative painting of a face, you know, representational painting, but it's comprised of these little abstract paintings, these little grids of abstract paintings. There's this dynamism, there's the sense of, like, movement and pulsing energy that the paintings have, because if at most distances from the painting, this now you actually see the different components, and they just kind of pulse a little bit. Mm-hmm. So there's this energy.
It's a very
field.
Elusive image. It keeps shifting on you. As soon mm-hmm. as you try, you see, oh, that looks like an eye. So if you look at it, all of a sudden it decomposes into its various incremental marks and stops being an eye. So it requires the active participation of the viewer, which is one of the things that I like about the way I work. There's a real kind of physicality to it, and both in the building of the painting, and also I think an active role for the viewer. You know, when an artist goes into the studio, there's a kind of ritual performance that the artist performs in the studio, but no one is there to watch it. The painting is really the evidence that ritual dance or performance took place, and it's the kind of frozen detritus of that experience, and it goes out and stands for it. It leaves the studio, goes into a gallery or museum, and it represents that performance. But I think there's an opportunity for the viewer, if the viewer can get in sync with the work, they can vicariously experience some of the things that the artist was going through, and sort of re-experience the performance itself.
You've done a series of self-portraits over the years, and those self-portraits are in your retrospective. How do you think your face has changed in the years that you've been painting it?
Well, you can watch me lose my hair. And I suppose gone is some of the attitude of the original self-portrait in which I was arrested in my James Dean phase, I suppose, the angry young artist. And I don't know. It's just what I've tried to do is construct a kind of timeline with my own image. That having gone through so many permutations and changes from either, you know, the early black and white pieces or the early continuous tone color pieces, which are actually made from superimposing a red painting, a blue painting, a yellow painting on top of each other, to the fingerprint pieces, the pulp paper pieces, and then the later oil paintings, is that it becomes a kind of cross-section through the... through the work. So it gives a chance to sort of see all the permutations and changes and devices and materials and techniques that I've used over the years with one basic kind of image.
My guest is painter Chuck Close. Since the 60s, his subject matter has been the face. Nearly 10 years ago, he had a stroke that left him partially paralyzed. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Painter Chuck Close is my guest, and there's a retrospective of his work at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Because you're sitting or lying all the time now, you can't stand or walk anymore, right?
Well, I can stand, and I can I could take a few steps, and believe me, it makes all the difference. I get in places where if I were strictly confined to the wheelchair, it would be difficult.
I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, since probably most of the time you're sitting, and a lot of the times you're talking to somebody, I'd imagine, who's standing, has your vision of faces changed? Because you're often looking up at people's faces instead of looking at eye level.
I was 6'3", and I always looked over the tops of a crowd. I never felt claustrophobic in a big crowd before because I could always see over the tops of everyone else. Now I'm down below even the shortest people. It's given me a new view on things. I don't know. You know, I used to always sit down to paint because I was going to be there for so long. You know, one of the funny things about being in a wheelchair, is that I look out at a world which is essentially unchanged. I used to sit, and I still sit, and I look out, and the world looks exactly the same to me. Other people look at me, and they see a person, you know, now confined to a wheelchair. So, sometimes when I'll roll by a mirror, I'll be shocked. I'll look and say, "Who was that?" And I almost surprise myself to see myself in a chair. And this has been one of the devastating things for my, you know, for my family, my children, and the people around me whom I love and who love me. Something like this doesn't just happen to the victim. It happens to everyone else. And I have to cope with all this stuff. I have no choice in the matter. But I think it's a constant reminder for everyone around me, the changes that have taken place, whereas I'm probably less aware of them.
Have your dreams changed?
Yeah, I used to. It's funny, when I used to dream for a number of years, I always walked in my dreams, and I was never in a wheelchair. In the last few years, I've been in a wheelchair, and then all of a sudden I would get up and start walking. And only recently do I have whole dreams in which I never leave the wheelchair. So I guess that must signify final, perhaps, acceptance of what happened.
Can you still take photographs now? Do you have enough control
I take all my own photographs, yeah.
What do you look for when you're photographing a face, knowing that this photograph is supposed to be a study for the painting?
Well, I try to engineer into the photograph issues that I'm going to want to deal with, formal issues and other kinds of compositional issues. Well, you know, whether I turn the head, whether it's shot from below, what the lighting... a range of grays, if it's a black and white photograph, or strong darks and lights, or things like that, interesting edges. But, you know, since 1975, I've been photographing exclusively with a very large format Polaroid camera, which gives you instant 20 by 24-inch prints. So when I photograph a subject, I'm involved with the dialogue with them from the beginning, because as I shoot each shot, the sitter has a chance to see what the last image looked like. Ordinarily, if we shoot with film, the image is captured on the film, and later that film was processed and printed. This way, from the very beginning, they have a chance to see how it's going. I can see how it's going. And we're involved in this sort of dialogue as we work together to build an image that they can live with, and that I'm pleased with, that I ultimately will want to use to make a painting.
One last question. I'm wondering if your paralysis has affected your life as the consumer of art. In other words, if it's affected how much or the kind of painting that you want to see, movies you want to watch, music you want to listen to.
Well, I still see a lot of art. I don't see as much art as I used to because I seem to be spending a lot of time doing things like this radio interview. But I really love looking at art, and I love my field. I love the looking at what other practitioners in my field are doing, and I spend a lot of time in museums and galleries, and it's part of a great fraternity, a kind of shared experience, and of course artists are especially interested in showing their art to other artists. People who know what it's like to make a painting look at it from a different point of view. So I enjoy looking at other people's art. Every time I see something, I think, oh, now there's something I don't have to do.
Chuck Close, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much for talking
with
us.
Thanks very much. It's actually very nice that to be on your show because I now paint almost exclusively to public radio, and so a great many of my paintings were actually made while I was listening to you.
Chuck Close. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is showing a retrospective of his work through May 26th. The exhibition will travel to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, the Hirshhorn Museum, and the Seattle Art Museum. The catalog is published by the Museum of Modern Art. A documentary on Chuck Close will premiere April 30th on WNET-TV in New York. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Phyllis Myers, with Monique Nazareth, Tracy Tannenbaum, Alan Tu, and Lauren Krenzel. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.